next installment of the Bakersfield Mastermind Group. I am Justin, joined as always by Drs. Juanita Webb and Scott Thor. And today we are talking side hustle secrets and really what are the ways that you can start a side business, grow a side business, look at making it more more than a hobby and into an actual career and profession. If you're looking for a change of pace, maybe you're looking for a way to spend more time with your family, whatever kind of those reasons and motivations are, maybe we can share a bit of why we decided to go that route during the live stream today. But I want to welcome you to this. This is our fourth one here over the last month. And so hopefully you guys are getting some value out of that. We will be monitoring the comments today. So whatever platform you are watching on, or if you're watching this on the replay, go ahead, leave a question. We will respond to all of those. But before we dive in, I asked Dr. Webb to share a word of wisdom, and she's going to lay it on us. I have no doubt about that.
Well, you know, as I thought about business and what really got me excited about having my own business, and I've had my own business for years, but to really find the intersection of passion and opportunity. You know, what really drives you? What excites you? What do you enjoy doing? And I really latched on to that aspect of it in my business that has just skyrocketed my business and really helped me to focus on what gives me the greatest enjoyment and also provides the service for my clients. So I'd say the intersection of passion and opportunity is just a real important concept to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can all echo that. It leads really well into the first question we wanted to ask today. So maybe Scott, I'll turn it over to you because I can echo that. But how do you determine if there's a market for your product or this area of interest, right? There's a hobby that's different than running a business. So how did you in your profession make that shift from, hey, I really care about some of these things to I'm going to make it a business?
Yeah, for me, for process improvement and financial coaching, both kind of took the same approach. I think one way to know if there's a market is to look at people that are already doing it. Like if there's other people doing it, lots of other people doing it, then that's probably a hint that there's a market for it. So like my financial coaching, there are lots of people doing it, lots of financial coaches, lots of different kinds of coaches these days. And the other thing for me is the data shows, you know, 70 to 80% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. So there's obviously a need, not that all of them are going to want help, but there is a need there. And the other thing is just simply to ask, start asking people on your social networks, hey, I'm thinking about an idea about starting a class on whatever it might be, for example, which is one of the hottest trends in side gigs right now is teaching online classes. There's a zillion platforms out there that are willing to host your stuff and do an awesome job. So it can just start by just simply asking, you know, friends, family, coworkers, acquaintances, your social network. I'm thinking about this idea. Would this interest anybody? Do you think there's a market for this?
Yeah. And I've actually found that it was more of an outgrowth for me from the career that I was in. Mine was really the opportunities that I had within the career and then being able to branch out and do that on my own individually. So a lot of that just comes from the experiences, you know, what you're currently doing. Is there something in what you're currently doing that really excites you, that you really enjoy focusing on? And then how can you turn that into a profitable business on your own? You know, is that something that can work for you? And so that's how I looked at it. It's been tremendously successful for me because I really found, like I said, that passion of what I enjoy doing. And when you enjoy doing it, it's not like working. It's really enjoying what you do every day. Yeah. So
I think you raise a good point, and it leads well into this second question, right? So you mentioned that it grows out of this hobby, this passion, but really it begins, okay, so maybe there's some interest. I'm not the only one that wants to be a financial coach and an HR person. I think it looks like there are similar books or products out there that maybe I could piggyback off of and build some unique expertise. But how do you really begin to find your ideal client? And I'll share, I think even maybe I hinted at this last week in the live stream, that I think a fairly popular way for coaches at least related to my niche to get started, is like you think I can coach everybody, and you can because the principles work, but then you have that bad client. You're like, I can, and I'll never coach you again. Right. And so you start this, like, mine honestly took me years to figure out, like, no, it's not quite that. No, it's not quite that. Right. And so only through, for me at least, through this reflective process of what did I like about this client and what did I like about this client, that I can kind of start to trace some of those threads together and really begin to say, it's not necessarily, at least for me, it's not a position, it's not a title. There's really a whole lot more about characteristics and attitude and values that matter that shape who my ideal client is. And so I have like this upfront questionnaire to just say, are we going to work well together? Because you've got to understand the ways I'm going to push you and the things that I need you to care about. Because I can't force you to care about those things, right? And I'll tell them, I can do everything for you except make you want to change. You have to do that yourself. So there's maybe a bit about my story, but Scott, Juanita, how did you guys decide, hey, this is my ideal client, and then really lean into that as you're building the business?
Well, I'll jump in there for a second. The majority of my clients have come from just personal contacts, the networking that I do. People have known me from various classes that I've taught. In fact, it's very interesting that a couple of my clients were my former students when I was teaching at the university. And so now they've gone on into being into business, and you know, they see that I'm this kind of service, and I say, hey, can you help me with this? So a lot of it had to do for me with the networking that I had done over the years and the people that I got to know. Others who had just a personal contact with, and they had a question or an issue for their business. So really it has to do with those personal relationships. But then I also do kind of like what you said, Justin, where it's like, okay, do I really want to take this person on as a client? Is this going to be a good fit or a good match? And I really want to look at, are they open to the input? You know, for all three of us, we provide a service business. We don't have a product that we walk out there and sell to someone and they walk away and take their product and go home with it. We're all three selling our services, which means that repeat business is important. And so we want them to be receptive or responsive to what we have to share. Does that mean they're always going to agree with us? No, but are they going to be willing to listen, take the advice, and then make a decision that can support their business or help their business grow or change whatever is necessary? So for me, it's really a willingness, kind of like you, are they open and responsive to accepting the input and then doing something with it instead of just, you know, paying me to provide information and they don't do anything with it? Yeah. Yeah. I want to be successful. Yeah.
Scott, how did you find yours?
Yeah, I was going to say what Juanita talks about is super frustrating when you want it more than your client wants it. And we've all probably been in that situation before. So some ways I've found my ideal client is by working with the opposite of my ideal client, you know, people that I don't want to work with. And it's like, okay, I need someone who's completely the opposite of Jennifer, or whoever my client might be that I'm struggling with. And one thing that I've shifted in my business over the years is I've changed my perspective from looking at it from the potential client's perspective of getting them to want to work with me to me setting criteria for people that I will accept to work with me. Not that I've got this huge ego, but I want to be able to succeed with the clients I work with. So what I've over the last year or so, I've really put a lot of time and effort into like, what is my ideal client, so that as I'm talking with a prospective client, I can share with them, hey, my ideal client is someone who is broke, is sick and tired of living paycheck to paycheck. You know, they've said, you know, I make too much money to be broke. Most of the people I work with have household incomes in the six figures, yet they have, I just talked to someone the other day who's making 150 grand a year and he had 50 bucks in the bank. You know, it's like, how does that happen? You know, it happens by being sloppy with your finances. And so that's one criteria to work with me, but they also have to want it. And so I'm looking for people that have passion and energy. And that's sometimes hard to pick up on a Zoom call. I do all my coaching via Zoom, but over the course of a 1 or 2 hour conversation with a potential client, you start to get a sense of, are they really serious about this? And so I've just created a list of characteristics based on clients that I've worked with in the past. and said, like, this is the person that I'm going to be a good fit for, somebody who's going to be passionate about changing their life, somebody's going to actually follow through on what they say they're going to do and the plan we come up with. And you're not going to always have the perfect client. Like, no client I would say I'm working with right now is perfect. You know, they like check all those boxes. You know, sometimes they slack off on assignments, but for the most part, more of them that I'm working with are more my ideal clients than they haven't been in the past. So I think it just comes with experience, because you'll start to know who is a good fit for you and who you see succeeding. And it's very much like when I work with business clients to help them develop their values. I ask, like, who in your business, if you could clone her or him, would allow you to take over your industry? And okay, that's Sally. Okay, well, what makes Sally such a great person? Those values are, or those characteristics, which could be viewed as values, are the things we want to use to bring in new hires and to be able to use to evaluate people as well. So I've kind of done the same thing with my clients, just looking at from a characteristic perspective, what defines them. And I've come up with just a handful of criteria and I share those with clients, and they can tell me right off the bat, like, that doesn't really sound like me. And I can usually sense it and ask questions around it that will tell me, are you going to be a good fit? Because ultimately, you know, all of us being, you know, coaches and counselors and helping people, we have to have a good relationship with them first and trust with them. And so, yeah, it really kind of comes with experience. You start to really learn who's a good fit for your business and your, in what you do. And eventually you get pretty good at very quickly filtering out or filtering in, depending on how you look at it, clients you want to work with and those you don't.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm reminded, one of my favorite quotes is from Andy Stanley, and he says, everybody ends up somewhere and some people end up somewhere on purpose. a rough idea of the quote, right? And so, okay, so we think there's an interest. We're working on this idea of the ideal client. I think that quote mirrors together that last question in this one. Who is my ideal client? And now, where do I find the time? I did this part-time for 5 years before I was like, it's time to do it full-time. And that's a much larger story than we dive into today. But it's one of those things that I think more or less we've all struggled with, right? And it's, you know, look, the honest answer is no matter how much you work, you can always work more, right? And so the answer isn't always work more or work harder. Again, shared last week, never met somebody who's looking for more things to do. So how do you structure your time in a smart way, that I've got a limited amount of time. Maybe I'm still working full time. Juanita, you could walk us through what happens when somebody gets, you know, furloughed or laid off and all of a sudden has some extra time, right? Certainly this last 14 months has changed the way a lot of us are working. But I started part-time, squeezing it into hours before the kids woke up. There's my short answer. How did you guys, when you were getting this going, find the time to take this passion, this interest, and start turning it into a real business?
Well, I'll see if I can respond partly to that. I think it's really number one, knowing what time you feel you have available. You know, how much time are you going to be willing to set aside for this? How much of your normal day is family time? I always encourage when I'm coaching someone, especially when they've got something come up, I'll say, hey, I'm available during this time. And they'll say, well, okay, that's my dinner. Okay, well then fine. I don't want to interrupt your family time. So helping first identifying on your own end, what is your available amount of time that you have, you know, avoiding your family time, avoiding your, you know, your social time, your whatever commitments you already have, whether it's in the home or, you know, in your ministry, in your church, whatever, taking all of that out, how much time do you really have to commit to this? And then figuring out, can I do what I want to do in that amount of time? And so really understanding what you've got available has got to be your starting place.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree, Juanita, that is, you got to figure out, yeah, what's your capacity? Another thing that I do is I actually will set a schedule for my working hours. So, like you, like both of you, and like many people starting a side gig, they're not going to, go out and get an office space. Usually I wouldn't recommend that. That's not a good place to start. Typically, you don't want to take on those extra expenses. So for me, it's like setting work hours, just like I'd be clocking in and out, you know, at a job, you know, I set work hours. The other thing that I've found that has been helpful for me that I often share with my clients that are doing side gigs is to find a space that is like your designated workspace. Like for me, it's right here in my home office, or for you, it might be in one of your bedrooms or wherever it might be, out in your garage or your basement. And another thing that I've found that helps, it's kind of a weird thing, but it's my shoes. Like when I'm like at home in my jammies and I'm all comfortable with my slippers on, I'm not in work mode. Like I would not go to a quote unquote real job in slippers and jammies. So for me, I put on my work shoes and like something happens, like my frame of mind changes when I put on like real shoes or my work shoes. And so I've just found like that's another way to like get yourself into the work mode and then communicate with your family if they're around that, hey, this is, you know, mama and dada's work time, you know, if you got kids or a spouse, and shut the door, find a way to stay focus, because you know when you get distracted, you're just not going to get anything done, and all the only thing you'll get is frustrated. So
yeah, and that's, you know, that's some of the same comments that you've made, Scott, are the same kinds of things that we responded with, obviously all the remote work now that's being done because of the pandemic and everybody having to work from home. And some of those same comments, you know, have a very specified place that you work from, get up and get dressed just as if you were going to work. Although I have to admit, I do have my slippers on. The one time I can be casual, right? Even at work, I'm dressed like work, but I've got my slippers on to keep my feet warm. So, so I mean, little things like that. But as long as you've got the motivation to continue doing the work, and you, like you said, set aside that specific time designated for work time and stick to that. Yeah, really important.
Yep. I know one of the things I look at with my clients is we look at your calendar, and we kind of do this in two phases. We first look at your calendar as you have it, and then we look at your calendar as it actually happens, right? Because we all say, I'm working during this time, and then I can go in and look and like, yeah, but you spent 45 minutes on Facebook. You can't tell me that was all work, right? And so I refer to those as energy leaks. We've got these energy leaks where maybe you did hop on Facebook to make a legitimate post, and then you started the mindless scroll, and 30 minutes later, you look up and like, wait, what was I going to post? So one of those things, you want to find the time, do a deep dive into your calendar, both what you tell yourself you're doing and how you actually spend your time.
Yeah,
just to
capitalize on that, one of the best things for me when I was getting started in doing a lot of this was tracking my time. I mean, really consistently tracking my time. I mean, I keep a log sheet of every minute working because that's how I bill my clients. And when I went back and did an evaluation of that to see how much time I was spending on email and how much time I was spending on, you know, not billable time, really was a wake up call and really helped me to focus and pay attention to the things that I needed to so that it could be billable. So, yeah.
Yeah. Scott, I want to ask you a question specifically here as our financial guy. And that is, so we're starting this business. How should I structure my finances with this side hustle? What's your kind of top two or three tips that could help us get this business going?
Yeah, I mean, the number one thing is to set up a separate bank account. Okay. There's no quicker way to get in trouble with the IRS than to have all this messiness of personal finance with business finance. And it doesn't cost hardly anything. And most banks will let you set up a free personal account. You don't necessarily have to have a business account per se to do business, but keep everything separate. The other thing that I think is important is to do at least maybe a quarterly, maybe a monthly profit and loss. So a profit and loss is just basically how much money did you spend and how much money did you collect, you know, and the delta between those two will tell you, is this venture profitable? And the quickest way to do that really honestly is just to see, you know, if you've got, you know, still got money in the bank, you know, you're probably making a profit, but if you're losing money, eventually you're going to run out of money. So having some kind of a monthly P&L, there's a tons of simple little Excel templates you can use for that for most startups. But the biggest thing is just keep it separate and, you know, use your business account for every transaction, for every minute little detail, because When you actually get ready to do taxes, it'll make life a whole lot simpler because the last thing you want to be dealing with is the IRS.
Yeah, absolutely. And even something as simple as QuickBooks can, you know, number one, it'll track it all for you. And number two, it'll give you those P&Ls really easily. Some of those simple programs like that can really assist and really fine tune for you where you are spending your money and where the expenses are coming from. So,
yeah. I finally pulled the trigger on starting my taxes last night, at least compiling the paperwork, right? And having an organization method is the number one tip, right? Don't just keep it in a shoebox. Well, I need a question for you because previously you mentioned you were tracking your hours and you had these, so you have these billable hours and then you have these non-billable hours. How did you go about setting up payments? Is there an app, a method, an idea behind this? How can I start to say, I've got this ideal client, I've got this interest, I've built this product or this service or whatever it is. I'm ready to make some money off of this. How have you personally decided to enter into that world of setting up and receiving payments?
Yeah. Well, it obviously that's one of the most critical factors for your business is making sure you receive some kind of payment, right, for your services. For me, because I had a legal background, I was used to tracking time and being able to run those kinds of programs. You know, there's programs out there, BillQuick, there's TimeSolve, there's TimeSlips. There's a number of different, I mean, if you are going to have a service business where it's not a product that you're selling, but you're going to have a service business, you do have to keep track of your time. And setting up something very basic, I used to just do it in Excel. And I finally got to the point of saying, no, I need something more, you know, appropriate so that it makes billing easier to my clients. I was spending hours on invoicing. And so I just got a new program called TimeSolve, and it's super easy, very easy to set up, very easy to use, tracks all my time. You can even, it even has a mobile app. So while you're out and about, you can just track your time on that. And then to be able to go back and see, oh, that's where I spent all my time. Again, it's a good indicator of where I'm spending my time and how I'm doing that. And it does all the invoicing for me. You tell it to do the invoicing, it'll you know, put it all on the correct invoice for the correct client. You can review it all, and then it just, you can automatically send those out, and then the payments start coming in, and you just track those as they do come in against those invoices. So I set up a very specific so that I make sure that every invoice is connected with the payment that does come in, so that I can demonstrate what has been paid and what's still remaining to be paid. So,
yeah, absolutely. Scott, I'd love your thoughts. I think you and I fall a bit different than Juanita does in terms of billable and non-billable hours. So it's good to have that well-rounded perspective. She's certainly tracking the time she spends with clients and doing the research and providing the answers. And that's certainly one method. It's not the only one. And so how do you set up your payments to make sure that all of this business stuff starts to flow?
Yeah. So for me, for my process improvement work, that tends to be very few invoices and in big chunks of dollars. So I just have a manual system for that. But for my coaching clients, my financial coaching clients, which I've got quite a few of them, I use Stripe and Venmo are primarily my two key methods of payment. And Stripe is kind of nice because it automates the process. I get their debit card or their credit card number, and it just automatically bills them for the coaching subscription we set up. And it makes it real easy because the last thing you want to do is be chasing after clients for paying invoices. I learned that lesson early on, that I don't want to be spending my time chasing after clients to pay. Venmo, I've been using with a lot of clients lately because it's just on the spot. We have a conversation, we're done. And they Venmo me the money right there on the spot. And then you can transfer it from Venmo if you want into your private account.
Yeah. And the faster you can get that return like that, the much better it is. Like you said, it takes the headache away of having to track down clients and, you know, follow up with them. So I've been exceedingly lucky that the majority of my clients have been very good payers and I haven't had to track down anyone. So, yeah. That's one of those things I evaluate before I accept a client. Be able to
pay me. Yeah, that's one of the characteristics of the ideal client is the ones that pay you on time, which I'm sure you guys have experienced with as well, like I do. You know, some clients just are just not good at paying on time. And
yeah.
But Yeah, that's an ideal characteristic.
Okay, so the follow-up question to that, how much do I charge, right? Everybody's, this is maybe the most important question we're going to answer all day, right? This is the one everybody wants to know. How much can I charge for my services? Who wants to take that one? I mean, I can walk through mine, but.
Yeah, and I'm just going to start with the concept that, you know, this is where we usually, most businesses of our type where you're consulting struggle the most because we undervalue ourselves.
Yeah.
And we don't understand the value of the service that we're providing. And I have, you know, clients that range from my standard rate to some discounted rates. It really is looking at what does the market bear? You know, what's the typical consultant charge, right? What are other companies that are doing the same thing I'm doing? What do they charge for services? How do they go about doing it? You know, what would be my typical income if I was in this profession working for someone else? What would I be being paid on an hourly basis? And then obviously adjusting that for being self-employed by, you know, marking that amount up enough to cover all of the expenses of taxes and those kinds of things. So even beginning from that standpoint is a good place to at least look and then go from there.
Yeah, I think this is, you're right, Justin, one of the toughest questions. And my general advice would be whatever you think you should charge, add 50% to it. Yes, because
absolutely.
They're almost everybody in the consulting coaching space undercharges when they start because they think that now whether I charge $300 an hour or $100 an hour, that's what's going to get me clients, but that's not, you know, what that will actually usually tell clients or potential clients is that, you know, if you're super cheap, there's something wrong. If you're like way off the spectrum of $1,000 an hour or something like that, there's something wrong. But most people undercharge, I think, for what they do, because price should be based on value and competition, right? It's like, that's why a Toyota costs less than a Rolls Royce. You know, one has a higher perceived value. And I find, especially with coaching, if you don't charge enough, the clients don't expect as much from you either. So it kind of helps you kick your game up a little bit too, when you're charging a more premium fee. And honestly, this is one of the things I notice about clients I work with is when they don't want to pay what I'm charging, I probably don't want to work with them anyways, because they're more focused on the cost. And I'm like, hey, I'm going to bring value to you. Now that you can't obviously charge double what the market charges, but what I found, like just talking to other people that do the work you're interested in doing is another way you can find out how much to charge as well. Talk to a few people. Cause when I started financial coaching, I talked to a bunch of coaches. And I heard everything from about $50 an hour to $500 an hour. So I was like, wow, it's all over the place. But I could definitely tell the people I was talking to that were $500 an hour were of a much higher, they were the Rolls Royce. And the $50 an hour was the Yugo, for those of you that remember the Yugo. You get what you pay for. So, but generally I would say, yeah, whatever you think you should charge, maybe charge more, about 50% more. And then the other thing that I did early on was to ask the clients, especially the ones that said no, hey, did you say no because my cost was too high? Was I too expensive? And I never, ever heard that I was too expensive. So I just kept raising my prices until I started hearing, I'm not sure I can afford that. So that's another way to find out too, is just to ask for some feedback from the people that do say no.
I think that's a good point. And the one that I was going to make is I think how much you charge is important, but how much value you bring is really the bottom line. Is anybody that's self-employed and running any kind of business, right? I don't care if you have a storefront selling goods and services, right? Selling a physical, tangible product. If your blue jeans that you hand make don't bring value to somebody, doesn't matter what you charge, right? And so it really, can you start with a question of value? And maybe the backside of that is realize that no matter what you price yourself at first, number one, it will probably change. And number two, you'll always doubt yourself, right? Like I remember when I got started and people started to call, I was wrestling with, do I charge them per hour? Do I charge them per month? And one of my very first clients were like, what do you charge? I was like, 200, right? And I was like full on puberty, voice cracked. And I wasn't sure. Well, it's no surprise that they told me no, right? Because I wasn't sure of myself because I was focused maybe more on how much money can I get off of this person and not how much value can I help this person find in life. And once you make that shift, what you charge really becomes fairly easy. These are my prices. And I know that, and I'm confident in that because I know the value you're going to get out of it. And then I think, you know, you set this expectation standard, and then you always work to exceed that. And people will always say, I've had multiple clients like, I can't believe you don't charge more. That's a really great place to be, right? Because it shows you that that value is really starting to be felt by them.
Yeah. And they appreciate when they do get that good quality product. When that bill comes in, they don't mind paying it then, right? They value and appreciate all that you did or can provide for them. And so they don't hesitate to pay the bill. So,
Yeah. One last thing there, Justin, is because I think this is a question many people struggle with is that two things I've learned, especially over the last couple of years is number one is when you talk to people about your price, talk to them about it as being an investment. This, whatever you're paying me should return far greater value than what, you know, the cost technically is. So when you focus on it as an investment, like sometimes people will ask me right from the start before I get to tell them all about what I do is from financial coaching perspective, for example, and they'll ask, how much do you charge? And I'll ask, well, how much is it worth to you to be debt-free for the rest of your life?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
How much is it worth, you know, but it's an investment. And the other thing, one final thing is that don't end on price. Never, ever, 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 ever end a conversation with a potential client on price because that will be the last thing in their mind.
Yep.
The way I end all my conversations with prospects is, hey, what do you think is possible if we work together? Like, what would be possible if we started working together to change your life? What changes would you think would happen? So they can actually start to talk it out in their own mind what the value might be. And I learned that early on because you end with price, they walk away with, that's $500 an hour for financial coaching or a couple hours that I do with my clients. They have that lingering. But if they leave with, wow, wouldn't it be awesome if I was debt free or whatever problem I'm trying to help a business client solve. So pricing is it's a tough one.
Yeah.
How can we make this transition? So we're billing people successfully. we've talked about maybe setting up recurring payments and what apps are out there, how much to charge. But how can we create and implement some of these proven processes, right? And so I'll start here. Here's one that I do. So every one of my clients gets what I call an executive playbook. And really it's the first quarter of our time together. During the first 12 weeks, you know that we are going to cover these topics. And most of the time it happens in order. I've tried very hard to say, how do they naturally build and progress from one to another? About 90% of the time we take it exactly as I have it structured in the playbook. But I also let the client know, I want you to look through this. And if you find that, hey, there's just this one topic that I'm wrestling with and I don't want to wait until week 8 to talk about this, you have every right to structure this as much as you want. You also have every right to say, this doesn't look particularly relevant to where I'm at. I really hired you for these particular issues. But this, like sitting down and creating this executive playbook, took me a long time and a lot of coaching practice to figure out, but it's now become the proven process where I, like, this is really what I pitch. Justin, if we work together, what's going to happen? Well, you're going to get this and this and this. You're going to find this benefit. I'm going to answer this question for you. And I give them a tangible physical product. Not really, it's digital, but they can print it out if they want to, right? They have this thing that they get from me upon signing up that they know at the end of our 12 weeks, we're gonna solve these problems. That's really been, again, back to that question of value, that almost negates the price because they're gonna look back at this product, or this package and say, we accomplished this, that's pretty amazing. So I offer this executive playbook that I call it, but what are some of those other proven processes and ideas and systems that you guys have created?
Well, I do something similar. I just call mine a scope of work so that I will provide the client with, okay, here's the things that we're going to accomplish for this fee or for, you know, during these, that you're going to contract with me. And so I'll just provide them a scope of work that details it. That way there's complete understanding on both sides. If they want to adjust it, we need to talk about it. If I need to adjust it or things aren't going the way we need to, we can adjust it. So I always want to have that scope of work because then both of us can go back and say, did we accomplish this? did we meet the objectives? Did it provide the value for the organization based on what we agreed to at the beginning? So having that written out up front is really important. So it's kind of like that playbook that you have. I just do a scope of work. So,
Yeah,
that's kind of how I do it as well with my process improvement clients, because they all come with kind of different needs and wants and desires. So it's just like, well, how can I provide value to you? Let's define what that work looks like. What is the definition of done in this process? So we can both agree that when we're done, we're done. And there's no arguing that there's something still left to be done. And then with my financial coaching clients, I've got really a four-step or four-phase process. The first one is called the digital coffee. Actually, I stole this from one of our friends, Tim McNeely. He and I had a digital coffee, which I thought was a great idea when people connect on LinkedIn. Hey, let's not just connect and run. Let's actually have a digital coffee. And it's like, I kind of swiped that from Tim. And so now with my clients, I do everything via Zoom. That's the first step. It's a 15-minute, tell me about your life, tell me about your struggles, your dreams, you know, anything you want to dump on me, I'll tell you a little bit about me. And we'll figure out, is this worth pursuing? Because sometimes you have that conversation and I use that filtering mechanism of like, ooh, I don't want to work with this person, is not going to be a good fit for me, or they'd be a great fit. And then we move on to a free coaching session, which might be a couple hours to dive in and talk about their problems and lay out two or three things they can do just right away, get started. And then if they want to move forward and actually pay for coaching, then we meet typically monthly for about 12 months. So I've got coaching session outlines laid out. And then there's a graduation. Most of the clients I work with, it's about 6 to 12 months. They graduate and now they're kind of on their own. And we come up with, okay, what does it look like going from here? When should we check in again? 6 months down the road, a year from now? But I think what really helps about having a proven process, it does a couple things. One is it tells your clients like, hey, this is what it looks like to work with me. In a very simple, I try to do this just on one sheet of paper, on one slide on the screen. But then it also shows your client that, hey, you know, Scott, Juanita, Justin, they're not just winging it, you know, because there's a lot of people out there that are winging it. Believe me, you guys probably know plenty of them. It shows that you actually have a system in place that works. That's why, you know, I like to call it the proven process. And I would call it that yourself too, because that way, you know, it's been validated. I know this works.
Yeah.
I like that idea of a graduation. I'm going to swipe that one, Scott. That's a great.
Yeah. I love that. It's kind of fun because it's also a selling feature, Justin and Juanita, because when you graduate, you can say, like, I've got a couple right now I'm working with that's about to graduate, and they've gotten out of a bunch of lawsuit debt. They've actually are going to have all their debt paid off minus their student loan at the end of this year. And it's like, when you leave on a high note, you want them to actually, they're going to help you get your next client. That's how I'm sure many of you, your clients, both of you guys find your clients, you know, is through word of mouth, you know? And so it's a great way to capture, all that you've been doing and send them out on a high so that, you know, they can tell other people about their great experience they've had with you, which could lead to another client. Yeah. Or they might come back later for, you know, some other coaching or advice that they might need as well.
Yeah, just don't forget to play pomp and circumstance for the graduation, you know.
You have like a digital tassel you can put
on. Yeah, and move their tassel,
So let's talk business details, nitty gritties here. The last few, we're going to talk starting the business. We're going to talk HR. We're going to talk about some technology, age, and a lot of those things to wrap up. I've had two pieces of business advice. I will share this and then would love to hear your guys' perspective. The first, when I was getting starting coaching, I reached out to my coach at the time and said, what do I do? And he goes, start as a solopreneur and just, or as a sole proprietor and just start coaching. You're fine. Second piece of advice, about a year ago, I met a financial guy and he said, what's your business structure? And I said, LLC. And he goes, you're an idiot. There's the two pieces of advice that I've had about being a business. So I want to sell a product. I want to sell a service. I want to have a brick and mortar store. Obviously, each one of those maybe takes a slightly different stance, and there's different legal requirements that we won't dive into all of that. We can talk about some of that stuff off camera. If you have those questions, let us know. But just kind of broad spectrum, somebody's getting started. Somebody reaches out to you and says, okay, I'm getting serious. Let's do this. How do you decide? How do you walk them through this idea of the business structure that's right for them?
Well, I think the first step is to decide, you know, how much liability do I want personally and on my family, whether I want to be that sole proprietor, like you talked about, or whether do I want to have the LLC or an S corp. There's great resources out there. You can go to the Small Business Administration. It'll give you the pluses and minuses of each kind of structure. So you can kind of identify it. There are some legal restrictions depending on licensing. I know one of the licenses that I have to be very careful if I was to go into an LLC setting, it would require additional insurance requirements. So you have to make sure you look into those kinds of issues dependent on the type of business that you're running and the types of licensing and that kind of thing that you have. So you just have to really know the structure, number one, of what you're trying to do, and number two, what's going to be most beneficial for you. For me, it ended up being an S corp. That was the easiest one to set up. I mean, it really wasn't horribly difficult to set up. I didn't have to use legal counsel. Part of that was because I'd done it in the legal field before. I had done set up enough corporations for the attorney that I worked for. I was able to just use, I think it's biz filings or something like that, and was able to go on and create my own corporation and do it that way. But pretty simple to do that and set it up. It's just depending on what's going to be most beneficial to you from a personal perspective, reducing your liability, and from a tax perspective, you know, and how it's going to play out. So if you do something other than a sole proprietorship, then you're going to have to file separate tax returns. So.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Juanita. It's, you know, it's really, it comes down to liability, right? Because and taxes to some degree. I mean, I am an LLC. All my businesses are LLCs. And there's a lot of simple tools where you can just look at like, well, which is going to be most beneficial for me from a tax standpoint? That's kind of right. One of the reasons why I looked at the two. You might have some clients, like in my process improvement work, I've had clients require that I'm an LLC or an S corporation. Mm-hmm. But it really comes down to like, what do you got to lose? You know, and for me, I've built some wealth. I've actually behaved well with my money, which means I've been able to keep some of it. And that has led me and our litigious society just to say, you know, I would be looking at an LLC or an S corporation because they're very little cost. The S corp is a little bit more paperwork than an LLC, but in general, it's like Juanita was saying, it takes like very little time or effort to set one up. It's basically a one-page form on the state of California's website that you can download and send $70, right. And I think is all it costs. But it's really, if you don't have much wealth or assets to worry about losing, you know, and getting sued, then there's probably not really much of a reason unless you're doing something where you have the liability where you could be sued. But like for my business, process improvement coaching and financial coaching, I'm giving guidance, you know, and there's little chance for being sued. But when you have something to lose, then it's probably time to start looking into that. It adds more expense too, because I think I have to pay an extra $600 a year for another tax filing. So it's that, and just, you know, it's a little bit more work, but in this day and age with our litigious society, you know, it might be worth investigating. Plus, the other thing that it actually does is when you actually have to spend some money to set your business up, it should incentivize you to do something to make that money back. Because it's like, I'm not going to pay, I can't remember what it is, $800 or $900 a year minimum tax you got to pay on an LLC. Yep. Even if you don't earn one penny, you've got to pay that tax every year. It might be the motivator to get moving on whatever idea you have so that you're not just throwing, you know, $700-$800 a year at it. You know, a tax that's going to the franchise board up in Sacramento for nothing, you know, so.
Yeah. And that's the same tax with a S corp as well. So you do have to pay the same minimum tax, the $900 or whatever it is a year. And like you said, filing a separate tax return, there is a cost to that. I actually have two businesses because again, for my licensing, it has to be a sole proprietor. The one of them has to be a sole proprietorship, but then everything else is run through the corporation. So I've actually got three tax returns, personal, individual business. Yeah. Lucky me. And then the S corp. So, yeah.
Yeah. Juanita, a specific HR question for you here as we look, we've got about 15 minutes left. Thank you guys for sticking with us. If you have questions, go ahead and leave those. But we're starting, we're exploring those business structures. We realize that there are some options. Again, maybe without diving too much into the nitty-gritties, because we can't handle all of that on this live stream. How do you decide that when you are ready to begin, that I'm going to do this myself, or you know, it's going to be me and I'm going to make my spouse work for free? Or how do you actually go about determining the right steps and time to hire somebody?
Yeah. Well, and there's some real concerns there because, well, at least here in the state of California, you do have to be very careful whether you're going to hire someone as an independent contractor or you're going to actually hire them as an employee. And there's been some new regulations, some new legislation that has come out over the last few years. It started several years ago with what's called the Dynamex decision, the new ABC independent contractor test that now has to be evaluated. So you have to be very careful in making that determination. Basically, in the state of California, the state is going to presume that every person who performs functions for you is an employee unless you can prove otherwise. And so you have to really be able to demonstrate how you decided whether this person is an independent contractor or they're an employee. Basically, the three-step test is whether or not someone, to be an independent contractor, are they free from the control of the hiring entity? So like each of us would be an independent contractor to the people that are our clients, right? Because we're not providing the same service to them that their business is providing. And that's the second one, that as an independent contractor, we have to perform work that is outside the usual scope of the hiring entity's business. So perfect example is if I'm a law firm and I want to hire an independent contractor lawyer, if he's providing the same legal services that I'm providing, he's not an independent contractor, he's going to be an employee. But if I'm a law firm and I need to hire a plumber to come in and fix my toilets, he could be an independent contractor because he's not providing the same kinds of functions that the law firm is doing. And then third, the person just has to be independently engaged or established as an independent contractor. So they have to have their own business to demonstrate I'm providing this service to multiple clients and not just working directly for you independently. So there's just some real concerns. You have to be very careful about it. If you are going to hire someone, then there's all kinds of setup that you need to do. You obviously have to get a state employment number. You have to get a federal EIN number to be able to file your payroll taxes and those kinds of things. So there's a number of different steps that have to be completed if you are going to hire someone as an employee as compared to an independent contractor. With an independent contractor, you still have to do 1099s at the end of the year and knowing at what, you know, where the breakoffs are on those. So you really have to pay attention or hire someone, a bookkeeper, someone like that, to handle all of those functions for you. And I would say that's probably what I have seen for most people. That's usually the piece that they outsource first. I don't know you guys, but, you know, getting rid of the bookkeeping and the payroll taxes and those kinds of things, that's something that you can easily hand off because that's not our area of expertise. And so that's the easy kinds of things to hand off, the payables, the receivables, all of that. That's typically the first step or the first piece that most businesses will hand off to an independent contractor or someone that they outsource those functions to assist with. So how do you decide if you need someone? Well, at what point can you no longer handle all the work that you're doing? Okay. You know, where is it getting to the point that you're encroaching on that family time, when you're encroaching on all of that social time and you no longer have the time to commit to your family and your social life? And now it's just consumed 100% with your business because you're doing too much, not only providing the service, but all the support functions that need to be done to keep your business going. So,
yeah, I think one of the other things you can do is I always joke my background is church work, pastoring, and the best line that you can always add into a job description for a pastor is the very last one that says "and other duties as required."
All other duties as assigned. Absolutely. So yeah.
That's how they avoid hiring independent contractors, because Justin, the toilet's backed up and your last line of job description says other duties as required, go unclog the toilet. So there's your little, like, as you're drafting those resumes, make sure you put that one in there.
Yeah.
Help you avoid having to hire more independent contractors.
I knew you were a good HR professional. All other duties as assigned. That's on every job. Yeah.
Okay. So let's transition to the last question here before we wrap it up. How can I implement technology to aid me? We live in a digital world. We're obviously broadcasting this on a digital platform. We've talked QuickBooks and digital coffees and maybe kind of like scattershot thrown out some ideas throughout the course of the last 50 minutes. But how do you use technology to help aid your business? Is it, what are those kind of corner pillarstone, those pillars that you have to have, those cornerstones that make your business run better? And how do you implement technology for that?
Yeah, like one of the things that I do, since most of my work is Zoom sessions, is Calendly is a tool that I use quite frequently, which is Calendly. It's C-A-L-E-N-D-L-Y, I believe, Calendly.com. And it's just a calendaring system where you can set up, like I can set up my 15-minute digital coffee. I can set up my 90-minute free coaching session. I can set up my two-hour standard coaching session. And that then links to Zoom. It links to all of my calendars, my iCalendar, my Google Calendar. And when someone wants to schedule with me, they go there and they can see my availability, and it automatically sets up links for Zoom. It sends me a text. It sends reminders. It sends me follow-up reminders to document, you know, what I've done. And you can even integrate payment into that. So that's one of the things. I mean, just managing your time, anything you can do to use technology to do that is huge, because that's something that I would recommend anybody starting, like, kind of a service side gig to look into that, because that eventually, when you start to get super busy, you're not going to have time to put systems in place, and there's not much, you're not generating any revenue by going in and scheduling appointments. So, so that technology has really helped me. The other thing that I've found, we've talked about Stripe already, you know, all the payment system processing, that technology is amazing. There's a cost to it, like Stripe charges, I think 2.9% plus 30 cents for each transaction. So there is a little bit there you've got to factor in. But then with social media technology, I use Hootsuite. So there's other platforms out there where you can post to a ton of different places and schedule. So if you've got a social media strategy, that technology is awesome too, so that you're spending as little time, honestly, on social media, because I'll give you a hint. There's not a lot of leads and a lot of clients. I don't know about you two guys, but I don't get much on social media. It's not like, oh, I saw your Facebook ad, or I saw that, you know, that meme you posted or that video you posted. That generally doesn't generate a ton of my revenue. It does generate a little bit, but it's a small percentage. So
yeah.
I think the biggest thing is the time and payments. Look for technology to automate those two activities so that you can focus on growing the business, not on doing the administrative stuff.
Yeah. And I would just say being willing to acknowledge when that's not my forte, right? So get somebody else to help you with it. I mean, I acknowledge I am, you know, technologically challenged. That's not my strength. And so I've got other people that come and help and do all of my Facebook and my posting and all of those kinds of things for me, because that's not my strength. And so use the technology to aid you, but don't let that become, you know, a yoke around your neck. Make sure you hire the people or utilize people who can provide those services for you more effectively than what you can do. So yeah, technology can be wonderful, but it can also drag you down if you try to, you know, do it all yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I would echo both of those. I would add in, I'm one of those few people that iPhone offers that screen time every week, right? This is how much use. I actually keep that on. I mentioned earlier this idea of finding those time leaks. And I actually leave that on so that every week I can go in and check and see how I'm accountable on. I have it on my laptop. I have it on my iPad. I have it on my phone. And every single Sunday morning, I get a text alert or a notification telling me to go and look. And anytime I see an increase in, hey, your usage was up, I don't care if it's, you know, 2%, I go in and look and see, hey, yeah, it was up 2%. I had a couple extra Zoom meetings this week because I can forget, well, why was it up this week? There was one week I saw like a 98% increase. I'm like, what on earth? I was traveling somewhere and I had navigation on and like never locked my phone, right? So good. I wasn't just wasting time, but it's one of those. I noticed one time I went in and I looked because it was up a lot. And it, over the course of a week, I spent 8 hours on Instagram. I'm like, I know that wasn't business, right? I wasted a full work day surfing Instagram. That's a problem for me, right? And so I implement technology. I use that to kind of hold myself accountable. That's how I came up with this idea of energy leaks. Like my social media usage should be 30 minutes or less a day outside of things like this, obviously, because that keeps me accountable to make sure that I'm doing things that, you know, like Scott said, social media doesn't generate a whole lot of business. It's a great tool and it gives me a good presence, but it's not where I spend the majority of my time. And so I automate stuff out and I actually keep track of all of those reports so that I know exactly how I spend my time. So yeah. Thank you. Any final words? I know Scott asked you to kind of close us with a word of wisdom. We are pushing up against that hour. We hope you have enjoyed being with us. I know we've had people on the whole time. So thank you guys for sitting with us, being a part of this next mastermind group. Scott, would you mind closing us out here and wishing us well as we continue to pursue this side hustle?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got three things that I think might help. The first one is just start, because how often have you come up with an idea and didn't act on it? You know, all of us probably thousands of times, right? Like think about, oh man, if I would have just started what I wanted to start in 2020, where would I be today? You know, I'd be, I think I talked about this in a previous broadcast. I'd be, you know, fluent in Spanish. I would have read, you know, probably 500 books. I would have wrote half of the novel I'm trying to write. So just start. And the other thing is don't wait too long to get something to your customer. Like if you can come up with an idea, the quicker you can get it to your customers or potential customers, the quicker you're going to get feedback, the quicker you're going to figure out this is not going to go anywhere, or hey, this is a pretty good idea, but I just need to craft it and tune it and tweak it. So do something quickly. The second thing I would say is set a time limit. Every business I've ever started, I've set a time limit. Like I started a business a few years ago and I set a time limit of 18 months. Okay, if in 18 months, I don't have this many customers, I'm not making this much money, I'm just going to pull the plug, you know, because otherwise you could be working on an idea that you have for the rest of your life, you know, because you just know this can work. I just got to do something different. So set a time limit. And then of course, my last tip is the obvious one coming from the financial coach, never, ever, 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 ever go into debt to start a side hustle, because you wouldn't believe how many people I talk to that have $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 worth of credit card debt. I talk to someone like this probably about every month that started some side gig, some side hustle they thought was a great idea. They bought a bunch of stuff and now they've got a pile of, you know, dead inventory in their basement nobody wants, or they bought a bunch of technology, they signed up for a bunch of expensive subscriptions. And now that's the worst kind of debt, right? Like you're paying something off that you've got nothing to show for. I mean, really talk about, you know, a bad decision. So, and today with technology and with so many ways to start a side hustle, it doesn't take hardly any money to get an idea off the ground, right? I mean, there's just so much technology out there, so many ways to start a side hustle with very little investment. So yeah, stay away from debt, because you'll definitely have a hangover from that. If it doesn't work out, that just won't go away, you know, for at least a few years.
Yeah. If you have product in your basement that nobody's buying, you'll hate going into your basement every time you do. So.
Yeah. And I just want to capitalize on a couple of things I heard both of you saying. And I think it's really important how much we have to monitor ourselves and be willing to monitor ourselves, whether it's our time, whether it's our commitment to finances, whatever. But we as the business owner have to monitor and know what we're doing. It's, you know, because we don't have a boss, right? I mean, we're the boss. We don't have somebody looking after us, telling us you're not getting this done or you're not getting that done. We have to be willing to use those tools to monitor ourselves so that we can stay effective. So, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Juanita. Thank you, everybody, for watching. We'll be back soon. We are planning out the continuing course throughout the spring, what we're going to cover each week. So stay tuned on any of our social media channels to keep in touch with what these future broadcasts will be. But appreciate you guys joining us today. Thank you, Dr. Webb. Thank you, Dr. Thor.
Thank you.
And we will see you guys on the next broadcast.
And thank you, Dr. Hebert. We appreciate you and all you're doing. So thanks.